Welcome to That's So Hindu, a podcast brought to you by the Hindu American Foundation. I'm Matt McDermott. This week, we're back to the Hindu at Heart series with Indu Viswanathan speaking with Sneha Rao. It's an extensive interview covering a wide range of topics, growing up a Hindu in the U.S., interfaith marriage, the challenges of having people embrace aspects of Hindu culture, but balking at Hindu religious expression, and much more. So without much further ado, get comfortable. Here's Indu and Sneha.
Welcome to Hindu at Heart. I am your host, Indu Viswanathan. Every episode, I will be speaking with an inspiring Hindu raised in the United States as they share their journeys, triumphs, insights, and the meaningful struggles that shape their lives. Join us as we explore the plurality of Hindu American experiences and perspectives. This episode, I am thrilled to be joined by my dear friend, Sneha Rao. Sneha is a first-generation Hindu American immigrant to the U.S. She moved to the U.S. when she was 13 with her parents. Sneha worked as an engineer and data scientist in the aviation business for over a decade before transitioning to study Hinduism, yoga, Hindu phobia, and decoloniality. She co-founded the Hindu Decoloniality Group on Facebook to create a space for decolonizing discourse about Hindus and Hinduism. Sneha is dedicated to raising awareness about Hindu phobia and developing scholarship to educate the Hindu community about these issues. Welcome, Sneha.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So let's dig in a little bit. Can you share a bit about what it was like growing up as a Telugu Hindu in Mumbai?
Sure. So Mumbai, where I grew up in Mumbai, was a very diverse but mostly Hindu neighborhood. And I went to an English medium school, but it was a school called Swami Vivekananda. So it was based on the values of Swami Vivekananda. So in many ways, it was really wonderful upbringing. I had a lot of cultural memories from that time that I still cherish to this day. One of the core memories that are like embedded in my brain is the Ganesh Chaturthi festivals in Mumbai. Every year, we used to call it the society, would pitch in money, and we would have like a mandap, and we would bring a big Ganesha. And every year was like the big talk of the town as to how we were going to decorate the mandapa. So there was like themes and it was fun. But, you know, also I remember like my mom carrying me in her arms to the mandapa, you know, for aarti in the evenings. And I have very, very like close memories, probably going back to like when I was 3 or 4 years old. So that was, I don't know if it paints a picture, but that was my upbringing in Mumbai. We used to have small temples in the neighborhood that, you know, we could always go and we'd hang out and ask for boons from Hanumanji. But also we had like a normal, you know, like what I would say what maybe more Americans would relate to too, that we'd run around and we had friends and we would talk about Bollywood stuff, right? So all of those things existed in kind of a very kind of together in a very pleasant way, I would say.
And would you say that that's really primarily how you learned about Hinduism, was through these cultural and social interactions?
Yeah, primarily I would say I learned about Hinduism through osmosis. that was, you know, we had something called moral studies in my school. And so we would get like tidbits of morality, like Panchatantra, that sort of thing. But it didn't feel like weird in any way. But mostly like most of the philosophy or anything that I picked up about Hinduism, I think the things that really stuck were the interaction, the daily interactions, the sort of normalcy of going to, you know, while you're walking down the road, there's a little like a side mandir that you just sort of, you know, tuck into, do your namaskarams. And, you know, that day, maybe you happen to find some flowers, you just offer it and you run to school. Like that was my, like, that's how I really understood Hinduism.
So it's really more than the philosophy or lessons. It was more the normalcy of expressions of bhakti.
Yeah, actually lots and lots of bhakti. Yeah. And shared bhakti too. It was like, you know, all my friends, we would just do that as like, you know, we're running around. We would just go, oh, you know, let's just tuck in and you'd run in and come out. Like it was never, it was just like in the air in a way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't think about Mumbai that way. Like they think about South Mumbai or like the fancy Bollywood people. But I don't think people understand this, like this beautiful, like urban expression of Hinduism in like the suburban areas of Mumbai.
Yeah. Mm. So then what was it like when your family moved to the US? What were some of the most significant cultural differences you remember at 13?
We moved to New York City and we moved to Queens. And our neighborhood, immediately what was very apparent was that we were no longer in a Hindu neighborhood. We were in a Jewish neighborhood. So we moved to Forest Hills. But, you know, in many ways, it was also very similar, like the urban environment. And actually Jewish people have a lot of like what I like related to as bhakti. You know, they had like joyful expressions and I kind of like connected with that a lot. But other things were like, suddenly I had to like explain Hinduism to people and I'd never had to do that in India. It was just, why would I need to explain this to anybody? So that was immediately like apparent that, you know, I occupied the space in a very different way, like showing up in a bindi meant, you know, maybe getting some side glances and like mostly curious, but sometimes a little bit, you know, bigoted, or that was also there. Like, why are you here? That sort of, you could feel that a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did that come from in school, or was that just walking around the neighborhood? Where did you experience that?
I actually mostly experienced that in school. So I went to a science high school in New York City with a very diverse group of people. And that's where actually I got a lot of like questions or even bullying. Like if I showed up looking too Indian or in a bindi, you know, people would like push my bindi as if it was a button. And one time, like one kid, he would do it every day. And I would like try to avoid the like paths that he would be on, but somehow he would like find me. And it just became like this like thing between us. And one time he actually got me in the eye trying to like push the bindi. So from then on, I was like, I don't think I want to do this anymore. So I just stopped wearing the bindi after that.
Did you tell any teachers or administrators that this was happening?
I did not. I just didn't feel, I was like 14 and I was in a new country. And I just wanted to fit in. Like, actually, I remember like really wanting to fit in because I felt like I was really standing out. So I didn't want to like, you know, rock the boat. I very quickly learned an Indian American accent to the point where now I like code switch without even thinking about it. Like with my family, I'll speak in an Indian accent when I'm taking English with people who I somehow in my brain code as American. I'll just switch to American accent. It's not, I don't even think about it. It's not like I'm faking it. It's just my brain just does that. So it was very important to me at that age to fit in. Like, you know, I remember having like fights with my mom about why I can't wear, you know, like sweatpants with the word juicy on it because it was like all the rage at that time. This is like the early 2000s. So it was just a very like core pursuit at that time to fit in. You know?
And how did your parents respond or react? Did you share with them the kind of bullying or glances that you were experiencing at school?
No, actually, I actually like purposefully didn't talk about my friends or anything that I experienced with my parents. I only realized that like in like retrospect, because like immigration itself was so difficult on the family. You know, we were like living with my uncle until my dad's job situation like became more stable, and then we were able to like move out. It was just like a lot of stress in the family around visas and H-1Bs. And, you know, as a 13, 14 year old, you definitely pick up on it. It's like you can't really not pick up on it. Mm. And also, like, I think I just felt like my parents were uncool. Yeah. Like they wouldn't get it.
Most teenagers feel that way about their parents, I think.
Yeah. So I didn't want to like want my mom to go and like make a fuss about it, you know? Mm. So like part of me was not sure that my parents would believe me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'd never experienced that in India. So I had no language to like tell my parents, like I don't even think the word bullying was really that understood at that time. I think it's like much more of a recent, like awareness around it is much more recent. Mm-hmm. So I just didn't talk to them about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you have a brother. Do you know what his experiences were? Did he experience similar things to you when he joined the school system here?
He was a little bit younger than me and he doesn't like to talk about it a lot. So I don't, and he wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like normal for him even in India to wear a bindi or tilak or anything. It was much more of a feminine, like the girls would do it, but the boys just didn't. So maybe he fit in just really much more easily than I did. And he was also a little bit younger. So I think by the time that he was in high school, he was more Americanized than I was.
Yeah. 13, 14 is a pretty unforgiving age in school for anyone. Never mind. So, you know, you described how you had these expressions or these experiences of just everyday bhakti while you were living in Mumbai. And then you moved here and your Hinduism was received in a certain way. And then when you got to college, what happened to your Hinduism?
When I was in college, I think I used to do a lot of practice as a Hindu in my high school years. But I think just the experiences through high school started like putting a seed in my brain that, you know, this was like irrational. A lot of that, like, I think a lot of in New York City, you know, I don't think you get a lot of proselytizing, like Christian proselytizing, like I've heard other people have experienced. But you do get a lot of like that progressive, this is irrational and all that. So I had that seed in me when I went to college and then I like went into a very technical field too. I went into engineering. And you're very much steeped in the idea of like being rational, being logical. And so I think that fed into it. And at that time, I think someone in my friend's circle like gave me a Richard Dawkins like book. And so I was like, yeah, you know, we have to be rational. So I really bought into that because my group of friends were very progressive and very atheistic. But I also only fit in with that group of people because my college was very white and everybody else was very Christian. So like there was a lot of, if I had to pick a group, I sort of went towards the progressive group because at least my cultural expressions were acceptable. And, you know, they weren't like, it's not the same level of conversion. Like they don't come up to you and tell you you're going to hell. You know, so that isn't there. So it just felt more natural to fit in there.
So the messaging was that, just to clarify, was that to be progressive and rational meant to sort of divest yourself of Hinduism because Hinduism is regressive and irrational.
Yeah. Yeah, especially practice. Like a lot of the people that I hung out with would accept cultural expressions. Like it's if it was like my culture to be Indian, like they would be happy to go to an Indian restaurant with me or, you know, listen to Bollywood music. But if it was like, if I was like openly saying, hey, I'm going to go and do puja today at the temple, then they would be like, oh, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. So it was like, parts of me were acceptable and the other parts weren't. And I don't know that I like really resisted it. I just accepted it. It was just like part of it. Just, it got kind of internalized. And I moved to atheism at that point. I was very actually militantly atheistic at some points and really like terrible to my parents. Like, gosh, I'm so glad they like put up with me because I would argue with my mom about why are you going to temple? This is irrational. And she would be like, this is my bhakti. This is what I'm doing. This is how I raised you. So I'm really glad that they were super patient with me because I was really annoying. through my 20s. So yeah, I think I would hate myself. I would just dislike myself. I would just,
I think we need to look back on our 20s with some self-compassion. So what prompted your interest again in Hinduism?
I don't know that it was like one thing. I think I remember like in 2015, I was like, at that point I was, you know, still early in my engineering career. I was working at a really good aviation company. I was doing like work that was really interesting. I was like basically trying to figure out how to build like super efficient combustion systems, which was like really, really fascinating work. I was in the lab, you know. It was, and I still remember thinking, but I'm still not satisfied. Mm. Like, this is what I've worked to. And I'm still not satisfied. And I'm like, what is going on? So I was telling my mom this and I just remembered this conversation. She's like, yeah, I mean, like desire is just like normal. Like you're it's never going to end. And I was like, but you told me if I got a career and all this, it would be good. And she's like, yeah, it would be, but it's still not going to, you're still not going to be finished with it. Right. So and I also had like an interest in going back to India to just visit. So that year I took like a 5-week break and I traveled to India with my husband, and he's white and he's also from a Catholic background, but he's also very like atheist in his approach, or at least agnostic in his approach. And I remember traveling to India and meeting all these people and just being reminded of like how much bhakti there is in the land. And even in places like Delhi, which is very westernized, you know, everybody that I met was like, so not everybody that I met, but a lot of people that I met were so connected with the land, with the devotion that I was like, and they were happy. That was the thing. Like that was the trigger for me. Like I was still dissatisfied, even though I was doing what I had set out to do. And I was felt like really successful. And then I met all these people in India for like over 5-week trip. We traveled like all over North India who, you know, didn't even seem to care that I had this great career, but were inherently supremely happy. Like they were just satisfied. They weren't necessarily always poor either. They were, some of them were middle class and some of them were rich, but it was just, I was like amazed that this was the thing. So that really what triggered me to say, okay, I need to go back and start looking at the traditions that I came from. Like, this atheism thing is great and I like the rational logic thing, but is it really true that I can't have logic and still be Hindu? Like, I, you know, wanted to see that, because actually I met someone who was a scientist, and he was like a practitioner and he had like this really great energy about him. And he was just happy. Like, he was like, you know, doing his work and still satisfied. And I was like, well, I'm doing this great work. Why aren't I in the same space as he is? So that, maybe that was a, one of the events I would say that triggered it. But really, I think, and at that point, I just started like looking at Hinduism, like reading books. And I picked up Swami Vivekananda's complete works and I read through it. And, you know, I still, as I went to a Swami Vivekananda school, I think that was just my first, okay, let me go back and see what he had to say. Mm-hmm. Really, it was the birth of my daughter. Many years after that, that really, you know, was like, okay, I really thought about how I wanted to raise her. And I was like, I want to have, let her have that, you know, experience of just sharing bhakti with all of these people, like I did in India, like growing up. And I knew I couldn't necessarily recreate India for her here, but I at least wanted her to have like some drops of it. And that's actually the point where I got a lot of resistance, not only from my friends, but also like, funnily from my own Hindu family, because they were like, well, your husband's not used to this. How are you going to manage that? And it was surprising to me how much resistance I got from my friends, even though they were supposed to be progressive and accepting. So I really started looking into, I didn't realize what I was experiencing was really Hindu phobia. Mm. And so that's really when I started getting online and looking at it for information, turning to like Facebook groups and that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah. What kind of resistance did you, how did your friends express their resistance to what you were going through?
Some of it was just that, oh, you're going to temple again. That's interesting. You know, it was kind of like politically correct, but also like clearly judgmental. Or, you know, you would like think about it later. It's like, wait, did they just judge me? Is that what happened? Mm-hmm. So it was some of that kind of resistance that I got from them, which was really surprising to me, because I was always expecting people to be accepting. Like, that was the whole brand of progressivism, right? Mm-hmm. Being accepting. And then also, like, my husband's like a very progressive person, but he, one day, and this is a crazy thing to do, and I would never recommend it to people, I was like, I'm going to be Hindu. So I went on Etsy and I bought some murtis, just the ones that I related to, like things I've seen, like Saraswati Devi, you know, Nataraja, because I used to learn dance. So I always like related to him in Shiva's, that specific form of Shiva. So I just went and bought one without even knowing how to do puja to Nataraja Murthy. Like, how do you do Abhishek? I didn't know that. I had to learn it later on. But, you know, as soon as those came into the house, my husband was very uncomfortable with it. And I was like, well, you always said that you were accepting of my culture. Well, this is part of my culture. This is, you know, if doing puja is part of my culture, you can't say that you want to, you know, he always likes to like brag about how much he likes Indian food and how much he loves Indian culture, at least at that time. And I was like, well, if you like it so much, then this is part of that expression. And so we had to negotiate a lot of that. It was like a surprisingly, I was not expecting to have to negotiate that much. But it was helpful that our relationship was very strong and we shared a lot of love for each other. Because I don't think he was expecting to have that reaction to it, but I think his upbringing, in a largely Christian environment, still affected, even though he had moved away from sort of like the overt religious expressions. But he still had that mindset that, you know, Murthys were somehow irrational, you know. And I do think it's interesting, like a lot of Christians who moved in the progressive direction, they don't actually let go of their negative feelings towards, you know, polytheistic traditions or Hinduism. But they'll like kind of like reformulate it as irrationality rather than idol worship or whatever else they want to use. Yeah. So we actually had a lot of these conversations and he was like, yeah, I didn't realize I was doing that. Mm-hmm. Like he had some realizations of his own, which was really, really helpful. Mm. So we did a lot of that. But from a friend's perspective, I think friends either expressed that it was irrational to do that, mm-hmm. or they just sort of dropped off. Like they didn't see me as a card-carrying progressive anymore. Yeah.
Simply for sort of rediscovering your Hindu roots and identity.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. How did that, I mean, you said that was surprising. How did you kind of fill up your social life then? Was that important to you to have friends then that supported your Hindu journey?
It was. And I was definitely like, you know, when you lose your friends in that way, it's not even like a lose. It's not like they no longer want to talk to me but they just sort of don't accept you, that the closeness is not there anymore. Mm-hmm. It really hurts you in a way that I don't think I realized how much it hurt me at that time. Mm-hmm. So I was very angry. And so I turned to social media. Like that was my primary way, and maybe not the healthiest way to react to it. And I think I was lucky to, you know, there was someone blessing me out there that I found really good and supportive people, and made new friends. And also, like in my own personal life, you know, I met other people who would identify as progressive, but because, you know, there was no like, oh, you are rational and now you're not anymore. The terms of our friendship was just that I was going to be a Hindu and they could be friends with me in that form. And so I met a lot of actually accepting people in like the last 5-6 years. Mm. And because I was being honest with myself and I had examined and addressed some of that trauma of like immigration and, you know, like the bullying that I experienced in high school and the sort of continuous narratives, I was just a stronger person. So I didn't like attract the types of people who kind of, have those tendencies to judge you on mm-hmm. your, it was much more, I have more friends who have curiosity and they're now maybe from different religious backgrounds. But it does exist. So it's just, it was a me needing to heal myself and then like now finding different friends. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about this idea of acceptance a bit, because, you know, what you're describing in terms of your marriage and the ways in which you and your husband negotiated this shift, right? When you first got married, you were an atheist, a self-proclaimed atheist, as he was. And then you kind of had this, you very much had this rediscovery of yourself as a Hindu, and you figured that out. What was your experience of entering this interracial and on some level interreligious marriage, even though neither of you were practicing your religions at the time of your marriage? You still came from different religious backgrounds. How were you each received by each other's families then? And then what does that look like now? How are you received or perceived? What do you make of all of it?
Yeah, I think actually my parents were really accepting from the get-go. Like my mom didn't like, so we started dating like freshman year of college. So what my mom's major like concern was I was being distracted in my studies. But you know, I think once she figured out that this was a serious thing, there was a lot of like acceptance of him. And I mean, she did bring up, oh, you know, it's going to be hard for you because he's different. You're not realizing that it's not when you get married, it's not just that you're marrying him, you're marrying his family into his family. And they have expectations for children and grandchildren, all this other stuff. So she did say that to me and I kind of brushed it off. It was like, I was like, no, we're just two individuals and we're in love and whatever, we're just going to make it work. You know, it was like a very dumb 20 year old reaction to actually some pretty good advice. Right. So going from there, I think it really kind of started dawning on us when we started thinking about marriage after college. And so how are you going to raise kids? That was a question that came up. And so I was like, well, we'll just do both. This is fine. And as soon as that, like my very naive conception of how it was going to look like, ran into the fact that his family was a Catholic family and you actually can't do that in Catholicism. Like you can't do both. Like you have to choose. You know, I, at least at that time, I at least had the, because I was an atheist, I was like, no way, I'm not going to promise to do both. Like, I want to have some of my cultural practices, even if it's just to make my family happy. Like, my mom really wanted, like, you know, the mundan and all that, those sort of things for the kids. So it was important. And also, like, the wedding, it was important to my family that there was a Hindu part of the wedding. So even though I was an atheist, I was like, no, you still need to respect my family. So I think that was really good. I think I've seen other people who don't do that. And it then like later on when they have a realization, it's actually really hard. But, it helped that I kind of at least, you know, respected my family's wishes in that situation. But as soon as the marriage and the family and joining of the couple, that's really when we started realizing that there was going to be cultural issues. Honestly, I never felt like there was a racial issue. Like it just wasn't our dynamic, but it was the cultural issues that came up at the point that we got engaged, really. And then when we decided we wanted to have a child, then like his family and my family, we were both were like, okay, are you going to do the, you know, mundan? Are you going to do the, you know, naming ceremony in the Hindu way? Are you going to baptize your child? And you know, the thing with baptism that when we researched it was that you have to promise to raise your child only in that particular Christian tradition. So we had to say no to his family. And because it was important to me that we have the Hindu part of it. His family didn't really like that much, but you know, at some point they accepted the things for where they were. So, I think once that acceptance came in, like everybody's relationship got much better. But in that period of negotiation, it was really tender. And we didn't always, like, I didn't always react with the most amount of love that I could. But it was, I think if I was to do it over again, I would come with a lot of compassion, but also in a way that I had some self-respect, you know? So, because I think what I saw at that time was either people, like Hindus especially, completely capitulate. And they're like, okay, whatever, we just want to keep the peace. So, okay, whatever you want, we'll do that. Because, especially once there's a marriage and you're married, Indian families, especially, like, don't like to see those sort of family units break up. So even my mom was like, you're married now, so you need to make it work. You need to like do the thing, blah, blah, blah. But I'm really glad that I held my own. I just wish I'd come at it from a much more compassionate position towards his mom, his family. You know, they had their own expectations of what their grandchildren or grandchild would be like. I didn't really have good examples of that in-between path where you have the self-respect with compassion. Until like much later, I would say. So anybody listening to this, if you know, when you're doing these negotiations, it's possible, but you need to have both of those things.
And then, you know, the second part of this, or the extension of this, and what you've described is based on relationships that you have with people, right? Relationships with your parents, with your in-laws. What about the outside world, outside of your family, how your relationship is perceived, is received? Let's say within the Hindu American community, what do you experience?
I think a lot of people assume that I'm like a ABCD type person, like a coconut. when they talk to me, they're like, wait, but your husband is white and you're really actually very Hindu. Because, you know, I'm also like a student of Hindu studies, and I have a practice and I have a guru. And I'm like, yeah, I'm actually very Hindu, and maybe not conventionally, like I don't always have like a bindi on or that, but in my heart, in my practice, in my day-to-day life, Hinduism is very much a big part of my day. So it's surprises them. Some people are suspicious. They're like, are you trying to trick me? What's going on? You know? And some people are just like really accepting. They're like, you know, okay, this is great. It's really good that your husband's accepting. This is a positive example. So you really have the whole wide range. What I've found with Hindus, Indian Americans especially, is that even when they first have like a negative reaction, they don't like hold on to that, which is like what I experienced with my family too. Like if they might have like a negative response, but once they come to the acceptance, they're like, okay, you want to come and have like dinner or, you know, so I think that's a really positive thing that I've experienced. So sometimes what I tell people is like having a little patience with especially the older generation is helpful, because they'll come around. That's really what it is. They'll always come around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate how much compassion you have, and how, you know, what you're describing really is about building bridges, building relationships, rather than kind of having like an ideological stance on this, which I know from our conversations, like you have experienced, right? There are Hindus in America, Hindus out there who have this very hard line that unless you marry Hindu, you can't raise your children Hindu. And your life is an example of how that's actually not true.
Yeah. I think also those people are mostly on Twitter, the hardliners. And what I've realized is the most vocal voices are on these social media spaces are really not representative of the Hindu American community as a whole. And really most people are too busy, to be honest. They're like, they have kids, they have work, they, you know, they might like you for other reasons. And then they're like, wait a minute, I like her because of this. And, you know, I can get over my sort of initial reaction to it.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to sort of separate that from there. But also I think, you know, maybe the expression of what is Hindu needs to be expanded. Like, for example, we celebrate Christmas because my husband is from a Christian background. But, you know, as this, like, I've always thought of it as, you know, this lovely expression of, you know, we decorate the house in lights and it's a dark time of the year. Like dark, literally, like the sun sets way, way early. It's cold. So it brings so much joy that I would be like, this is completely in line with Hinduism to bring that joy that, you know, it almost feels like, you know, there's almost something like sacred about it, right? So it's hard for me when that expression is so much such joyful expression, it's hard for me to be like, I'm going to reject that. I'm going to hold a hard line against it, you know? And also like for kids love celebration and they love magic and, you know, you want that in their childhood. So, it's just for me as a Hindu American mom, especially is like, it's hard for me to hold the line against things that just are love and joy. But obviously, like you can have negative aspects of the culture that maybe it's good to resist, like the over commercialization of certain festivals. Now that my daughter is five, we like have conversations around that because she's also more interested in things. She's like interested in having that new toy or the bike or whatever it is. So I guess what I would say is, for me, the expression of Hinduism is in the values. Like I look for things that are aligned with my values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I would say there's as much of an argument to be made, especially in India, that a festival like Diwali has been commercialized as mm-hmm. much as Christmas has been commercialized here in the United States. So it's not like it's not like any market is inoculated from that tendency. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about how did you introduce Hindu traditions to your daughter who is, I mean, you said first gen, I would say you're like 1.5 gen because you came here at 13. So your daughter's like 2.5 gen.
She's 2.5. Yeah.
How did you introduce her to Hindu traditions, to Hinduism?
I think for me, it was a lot of experimentation, like to see where, you know, she was like becoming inquisitive or enjoying or so that was important to me because, you know, I've met like people within my own family who were like, you must learn this shloka. And if you don't, you, you know, aren't like, you know, practicing enough, but it almost like took the joy out of it. The thing that has worked for me, is, just like like Panchatantra, you know, simple things like actually the moral stories, even though she, like all these Panchatantra books have like a moral at the end of it. And she's now, she's trained. She's like, what is the moral? I'm like, you tell me. So, but, you know, we just having a lot of discussions. I think bringing examples, like actually being knowledgeable yourself is really helpful because we go hiking a lot. Like she has been into nature since she was like 2 years old. And so we walk a lot in like parks and stuff like that. So I will talk to her like, oh, you know, Bhumi Devi is coming and giving us flowers now because it's springtime. And aren't they wonderful? And that sort of thing she really relates to, because then she'll tell me, oh, is Bhumi Devi, why are the leaves going up? Does Bhumi Devi not like leaves right now? She's like, no, you know, they'll come back. It's just the time of the year for the leaves to, you know, drop and the earth to renew. Bhumi Devi also has to rest and renew herself. So that sort of very making it relevant to her in her kind of day-to-day life and the way that she thinks about things, at least for me, works much better because A, I'm not like that studied in reciting shlokas and, you know, memorizing different shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita, though I understand the Bhagavad Gita, but I wouldn't be able to recite it like off the top of my head. But I would say set, like making the world sacred, like, because a lot of Western culture, like, removes the sacred elements. It's very material. It's like, this is earth and this is dirt and it's not living. But when I have made things that she experiences or as part of her process of inquiry, sacralize the thing, that's when she really relates to Hinduism.
Oh, that's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. I know that she gets pretty excited about puja.
Mm-hmm. So she gets really excited about the first part of the puja, where you're putting the flowers and the rice, the kali kumkum, the offering, but she still doesn't have patience for the the stotrams and that. But I think what we have been able to do is I found like booklets from HSS, which give like small, tiny versions of puja. And those resources have been really helpful. So when she's a little older and she wants to like learn a longer stotram or do the longer process, she has the knowledge on, okay, these are the steps and I can make this step longer. And I can do more deeper practice around the step and that sort of thing. And also, she's a very why kid. So she's like, why do we offer hibiscus to Ganesha? But for Saraswati Devi, we have to offer only white flowers. And I'm like, and then sometimes I'm like, well, Ganesha really loves hibiscus. You know how you like different flowers sometimes, or you don't want to wear this dress versus that dress. So Ganesha has a preference. He really loves red hibiscuses. So if you can give him that, he'll be really happy, though he will always love, like I always tell her, like, even if you can't find the exact right thing, you know, he'll always love whatever you offer. But sometimes he's more delighted by the red hibiscus. Or I'll kind of give her those sort of explanations. And she really relates to that, you know, because she understands like sometimes she can eat. I forget like what I gave her. Oh, she really likes dosas. But so I said, like, you know how sometimes I'll make you idlis in the morning because it's I need to get you out of the door. We just had this conversation. But you really like dosa. So on the weekends, I'll actually make you the dosa and you really, really love it. So Ganesha is like that too. If you offer him something, he loves it anyway. But if you offer him this one extra thing or this special thing, then he'll really, really love it. And then she's like, I want to make him really, really happy.
Oh, that's
so good. Yeah. I try to like make it relevant for her life. Mm. Yeah.
So she's growing up in a very different environment, not just at home, but, you know, where you all live than where you did in a different time. What has been her experience being out in the world as a young Hindu American girl?
I think for her, it's a dichotomy. It's like, and it's like she has her school and she can tell the difference. She has her school friends, and during school days, she does not want to wear the bindi. Like, she will refuse to do it. She's done this since she was 3, actually, which is really interesting how young kids can be when they realize these differences. But on the weekends, we do Carnatic music and we do Bal Vihar. And sometimes we'll, you know, go to temple or have some other activity. And she has Telugu class too. So she loves wearing bindis. Like, she'll like go through. My mom traveled to India. She went and got like these, like just giant pack of bindis. So she loves to go through that pack and put one on. And, you know, she'll like pull out her Indian clothes and she loves wearing pavada. So it's like a lot of outer stuff, but also, you know, she loves like just saying om. Like, that's kind of like her daily practice. And she'll say stuff like, oh, that really like, the vibration was really good.
Oh.
Yeah, she learned that word, vibration. But also she'll say like, vibration was really good.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet. And again, this thread that's so beautifully coming through everything you've described, which is compassion, love, joy, expression, acceptance. This is really what's kind of holding the space for all of this in your family, in your life. And I really appreciate how you talked about it as really engaging in Hindu expression in America through Hindu values. I think oftentimes that conversation about Hindu values is reduced to this generic, like family values, tradition, but tradition that's not really interrogating what that word tradition means. And so it's just traditional in the sense that like every family has to look the same, no divorce, good kids who obey their parents. But that's not really what you're describing here. You're describing something else, which is having reverence for the planet as a value, as a Hindu, right? It's how you engage in the world and not what your family looks like.
Yeah.
Which is really beautiful. And I think a lot of younger Hindu Americans, it's good for them to hear this because I'm sure that they're navigating this, right?
Yeah.
They need to know that there are alternatives. Another thing that you mentioned that I do want to explore as much as you're comfortable doing is you mentioned you have a guru, and you and I have talked a lot about how much anti-guru rhetoric and, for lack of a better word, sentiment there is within the Hindu community. So why is it important for you to have a guru? How did you know that this was your guru? You can share who the guru is if you'd like. You don't have to, but.
Yeah. I think, you know how I mentioned that I didn't have any examples of how to navigate conflict or difficult situations with compassion. And so when I didn't have that, my reaction was to like, you know, kind of mean and unbending and, you know, hurtful sometimes, right? But also coming from a place that I was wrong. Because the only other option that I saw was that you completely capitulate, you have no self-respect, And, you know, I'm not the person to go for that option. I'm much more of the fight than the flight. So I think when I started getting, you know, connected with my guru, Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, I think you were the one who introduced me or encouraged me to take a class, like take a sky breath class. And I started watching like the wisdom series, especially the Yoga Sutras. I really related to his commentary on the Yoga Sutras because he had this one like clip or piece of it, which talks about karuna or compassion. And it was like, it came to me at the right time when I was having a very, very bad time with my family. And also like on top of that, I was having like a very bad, like, a fight with a friend. So, you know, his ideas around karuna and how to be compassionate, but not necessarily, you know, do compassion, he explained, was it wasn't just about doing whatever the other person wanted you to do, because actually that wasn't, it wasn't actually a good thing to do for them. If they were hurting you or other people, to capitulate actually in that position, at least the way I interpreted it, was that you were actually also hurting them because you were allowing them to do this adharmic thing. But so he was like, you can distance yourself, you can, you know, hold yourself, but also be compassionate towards them. And I think that sort of message really started healing my own relationships, like the fighting, the arguments with my parents or his parents or him and my husband. You know, when I had that like seed of compassion and the example that Gurudev was setting, because, you know, he was also like, you know, negotiating and conflict resolution, like he was involved with the Ram Janmabhoomi issue, was what I needed to live this, you know, path. Yeah. So I think that sort of kind of built a lot of like Shraddha in the guru. And then I was like, okay, now I have the Shraddha. I can like, you know, so when the thing about Shraddha is that once you develop it, you can maybe do things without necessarily always fully understanding why, and know that someday you will. So, and that's happened to me a lot since I've been on this path, is that I will not always understand why he's telling me or why he's advising the Sangha in a certain way. But then like in retrospect, I'm like, oh, that's why. And when you have that Shraddha, you can like be at peace with maybe not knowing everything right away. And knowing that it will be okay. You will come out of it. You know, like that really helped me kind of build or accept him as my guru. Yeah. Mm.
What are some of the misconceptions or ideas that you see floating around about gurus within the community?
I think one is definitely like the guru has to be very traditional, like whatever that means. So there's a lot of like negative feelings or negative conceptions towards quote unquote modern gurus. And especially with Gurudev, he's built out this huge organization, Art of Living, and they do operate in a kind of like a more what might from the outside be perceived in an un-Hindu way, because they are working in a global world with which basically works transactionally. But I think what people should really do maybe is to look at the inside a little bit more. There is true, like there are gurus who do abuse their position. But not every guru who creates these organizations is going to do that. And there might be very legitimate reasons for that. So I would always recommend to people have a little bit more patience and see whether the guru is actually still rooted in Hinduism. And I will say from my own experience, Gurudev is very much rooted in it. Like, you know, one of the requirements that Shankaracharya puts out is that they have to be, have a lot of vairagya, they shouldn't be attached to material things, right? And I've never experienced that with Gurudev. Anytime he's, you know, he's built out this organization, and yes, you do have to like pay for classes up front and all that, but all of that goes to sustaining dharma in a world where, you know, back in the day, like, you know, before the British, we had a system where the king would patronize the gurus, like make sure that they were able to provide for their shishyas. But that is not the world we live in today. So gurus who want to do these sort of works and have a global, you know, organization which is doing a lot of good work for mental health and even like conflict resolution, you know, Gurudev goes to, I think he was in like Saudi Arabia or one of the Gulf countries, and he was trying to negotiate peace, right, for Israel and Palestine. I think that to be able to do that, you have to run your organization in a way that makes sense in the world that that organization occupies. And I'm not like dissing the Mattas, like they have their own role to hold the tradition in India, to, you know, honor the land. That's all part of the same ecosystem rather than in a competing way. I think that that's really what I want to tell people is like, these things don't compete. They are complementary to each other. And what Gurudev does is not in opposition to quote unquote, a traditional guru who's sitting in a matta. And rather he like Gurudev went to and honored the Shankaracharyas at the mattas during the Pranapratishtha when they disagreed with something that the way that the Ramjan Bhumi was being run, he went and approached them and sat at their feet and tried to convince them. And he actually got a couple of them to convince. So he's not dishonoring them. He doesn't see them as something negative or, you know, he's not trying to replace them. He's not like he's not saying it's progress to have this sort of organization versus that. He's just saying, this is the world we live in and we need different approaches to different things, and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This leads me to, I know you recently wrote a paper on how Hinduism is not a British invention. This is an idea that circulates all over and people seem to have internalized this idea that Hinduism, the term Hinduism and the concept of Hinduism as a unified thing, as a thing, as a religion, was actually British invention. And this is an incontrovertible fact that you can't deny this. But you take issue with that. And you actually recently wrote a paper on this. You want to illuminate for our listeners on this?
Yeah, sure. So this is a class paper that I wrote for Readings in Modern Hinduism class that I took with Dr. Bakshi. And it was really, first of all, like, I think a lot of Hindus who are on the other side where they're like, no, no, Hinduism is all united and all that, aren't actually reacting to what they don't actually understand the argument. The argument, they'll say, oh, but the word Hindu has been in like the usage since the Persians. And it's derived from, they'll give you the etymology, like it was derived from Sindhu and this and that and that. And, you know, it's not new. The Chinese used it. All true. But the scholars who say this are not actually saying that the word Hindu hasn't existed or before the British. What they're saying is that the word Hindu was used in a much more like diffuse ethnographic, geographic thing. And the religious consciousness, the religious identity consciousness didn't really exist till the British. And that's really where we need to understand their argument fully before we react, because we just start looking like idiotic when we just say, we had the word Hindu existed. You know, that's not what they're really saying. This argument that Hindus didn't have a religious consciousness is kind of partly true, but I think David Lorenzen does a really good job laying out the data that shows that the Persians recognized Hindus as a religion, as a cohesive religion, going back to the 900 AD. And so did it wasn't Monier Williams was the one whose work on Hinduism became really popular with the British, which is true. And that was in the late 1877 or something under the Asiatic Society. But before him, his standard model that he puts out, which is that Hinduism is united. There are many sects, but they basically what they're doing is they're interpreting the same set of texts slightly differently. But that doesn't mean that they're not one thing. And they have a lot of commonality between practice and also share the same historic itihasic understanding of their place in India. This was his standard model that he developed because he was getting input from the Brahmins. When you go and look back, David Lorenzen traces this back to this view to the early 1600 missionaries that came from Portugal and Spain, and the British would not have access to these documents because they were in a different language, and they went back to Portugal rather than England. And at the time, the documents just weren't circulating the same way as they do today. So he shows that the view from the outsider perspective, every outsider who came to India, including the Persians and the Turks and all that, had saw the same thing. In addition, he also points out the constructionist scholars, the ones who believe that Hinduism was invented by the British, point to this one piece of evidence that the Brahmins never actually acknowledged Islam, even though they had interacted with Islam, or Islam had been in India for a long time in their Sanskrit texts. So the Brahmins never... they kind of vaguely talk about Muslims and the Islamic invasions as either West Asian. They have very geographic ideas. It's West Asians, or they call them Turkic or that, but they never and the word Musliman has, there's only one reference to it in 600 years pre-British. Okay. And this is all true. But David Lorenzen then pulls out and says, well, the Brahmins might not have, but the vernacular people, the Hindi speakers, the Kannada speakers, they were definitely talking about Hindus and Muslims, in their own works. The Bhakti saints were all talking about, unity between Hindus and Muslims. That was a big theme in the Bhakti thing. So clearly the people must have had this identity, this religious consciousness. And they weren't just talking in terms of geography. They were talking in terms of practice. They were saying that, hey, your practices might be different, but your underlying, the God is one, right? So they kept kind of pushing for this unity between the Hindus and the Muslims. So clearly there must have been a difference. So at least to the Islamic era, the Hindu religious consciousness extends at least to the Islamic era. But I think it also points to, he never really fully explains why the Brahmins never address this inside the Sanskrit text. And I think it points to the fact that the idea of a religious consciousness itself to prove unity between Hindus, okay, specifically to say that Hindus had a common set of practices and ideas is really not a good construct, good idea, good framework to even look at it, because, and I think you have to go to a different author, Madeline Biardo, where she points out that looking at Sanskrit texts in a historical way doesn't even make sense, because the Brahmins themselves didn't view themselves in a historic way, like in a linear historic fashion, but rather saw Sanatana Dharma as eternal. And what they did is they always just reinterpreted the Vedas. They were stewards of the Vedas. Bharat was the center of the world. And Sanatana Dharma was eternal. So they had no reason to ever look at things in a historical way. They might have said, okay, this is a difference in practice, and the different sampradayas might have interpreted the Vedas differently. But in the end, they had some very core similarities in that, A, they all use Sanskrit. They accept the Sanskrit as a sacred language. They saw themselves as eternal, and they understood that they were reinterpreting the same set of documents, the same set of, the Vedas. They were essentially reinterpreting the Vedas in relation to the Dharma of that land, that those people, those linguistic traditions. So they basically had this kind of bigger understanding of Sanatana Dharma. So even though we would observe that as diversity, and maybe someone from the outside might see them as very, very disparate practices, internally, the tradition, the stewards of the tradition who were writing the text, who were maintaining the Sanskrit and passing it on inside their gurukuls, didn't actually view it that way. So it doesn't really make sense to see Hinduism as from merely that religious consciousness lens, and then say, oh, Hinduism didn't have a religious consciousness. Even if you extended that back to like, okay, maybe they didn't have religious consciousness past the Mughals or the Islamic era. Even that doesn't make sense, because, the identity element isn't really needed when you're not being attacked. But the Brahmins themselves understood that there was this larger unity in the practice and the tradition, and they were the stewards of the tradition. That's basically what I concluded in my paper, but I think that it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think like a lot of things, it requires, as you described, patience to actually sit with the details and constructions and understand how something as seemingly universal as the term religion or religious consciousness actually does not have a universal definition, but how many people who are typing away on the internet have the patience. I mean, or unfortunately, even there are scholars who don't have the patience or the interest in interrogating their universalized definitions. So, speaking of which, you co-founded Hindu Decoloniality on Facebook, which has become a very popular site, so popular, in fact, that the group and you were misrepresented in a recent scholarly article. Tell us a little bit about why you founded the group. What are some successes, some struggles of the group that the group faces? Tell us the story of Hindu Decoloniality.
Yeah. So we founded this group about 2-3 years ago now. And it was basically meant to be a place where people can come and discuss things. But at that time, there was already like a lot of different Hindu groups. And what we noticed was they would always be sort of dominated by a particular type of Hindu voice. And that voice would be like, this is tradition, this is what we're doing, and we're opposed to all these things. And they were also not taking up issues of like racism, for example. Like the dominant thing from that side was, okay, We don't accept anything. We don't believe that racism exists. Like, there was a lot of like right wing, Western right wing narratives that were running in these groups. Let's put it that way. And so we saw that the space for people who want to understand these issues, not just in India, but also like across the globe, wasn't there. So that's why we founded Hindu Decoloniality. We used to call it Hindus for Decolonization, but now it's called Hindu Decoloniality. And we wanted a space, A, for resources, so people can come to us with questions. Like, if you just want to know something and you heard the wrong thing, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. When I was recovering, when I was trying to recover my Hindu traditions and ideas, I came across a lot of misinformation and I had to navigate that. And I was very thankful that I had good advisors and people like I met who were directing me in the right way to the right people, to the right gurus. And also, I think I was a little protected because I went to a school that was Swami Vivekananda, based on Swami Vivekananda's values. So, you know, I had that reference in my mind, but I also realized there were many people who didn't have that. So this was a group, like if you had a question and you wanted to find just like information and you said, oh, I saw this thing on this other webpage, it doesn't sound right, can you give me another opinion? Then this could be the space for that. And also like discussion forum, which didn't go into name calling. We saw a lot of name calling in other groups. So we had to set like tight rules, not rules, but like guidelines. And we were committed to doing moderation. Like we were committed to doing good quality moderation where we allowed for discussion, but also, if someone was getting abusive or there was like ad hominem attacks or someone's arguments just didn't make sense, that we would have like an admin group who would then go and like do some research, come back and, you know, have better answers. So that was a commitment that we made. And I did for like almost 2 years where I would come across something and then I would like go find answers. But I also learned actually that I needed to be more tolerant of different views. I need to be more tolerant of more global views because I'm situated in the United States and the way that race is taken up here, especially, we had a lot of debates around like racism and why Hindus should or shouldn't take it up, or why shouldn't that be decolonial? Why like right-wing positions, like Jordan Peterson's really popular in the Hindu American community, why some of his positions don't make sense from a Hindu perspective. So my first reaction was always just to shut it down. And then I realized, no, I need to actually allow these conversations to happen. And sometimes they might not always resolve. So like in that time, there was a lot of growth for the admins, I think, out of that group, and learning. And I had to like look up, okay, how would a Hindu actually like have a debate around this? And so I had to learn about Vada and all these other disciplines. So it really enriched me in my learning process, I think. And I hope that like people see that as a shift in the tone of the group as well. It's really, now I've come to a point where the group actually runs on its own without like there's certain norms that are set in the group, and people know that when they are coming into the group that there's certain expectations of how they're going to have discourses and all that. And when there's a new person who doesn't do that, this, you'll see someone be like, hey, don't have an ad hominem attack here, like that's not okay. Yeah. So it's really that's how we have really thought about ourselves. I think we do attract like a younger crowd too. Though Facebook itself is sort of kind of for the older generation now. But I've heard younger people who say, oh, you know what? I know your group exists. I don't always interact there, but if I want some kind of information, I'll go to that group just for a log into Facebook, just to like ask a question there, you know? So I'm like, wow, I'm like working for Facebook here.
Yeah, that's my praise for the group. Let's take a moment to debrief on the ways in which HD and you were misrepresented in that article.
Oh, yeah. So I forget the exact details, but HD was represented as this Hindu supremacist group. And specifically, it was around the caste issue. So we have done a lot of work and a lot of research, and we have guides actually that have we've had discussions around caste and I think words like chandal and how they relate to caste. And we've added all of those discussions without any editing into the guides of the group so that anybody can go into the guides and see all the caste discussions we've ever had. And we've also added like scholarship. Like, what are the scholars saying? What are, you know, so it's like a pretty substantive resource for anybody who wants to go and see not only discussions, but also scholarship. So I, at some point, you know, somebody asked a question about caste, and basically I commented, well, caste is, the word caste itself was, you know, a Portuguese thing. And the way that it was implemented was really a British product. Of census. And this was taken out of context that I was denying that there was caste discrimination, which is not what I was doing. And I think if anybody had they fully represented the group's views, because I probably have lots of different comments over, you know, months and months of stuff that we've discussed, they would have seen that I wasn't denying, I don't really have the data to really know whether there's caste discrimination or not. And I haven't lived in India for almost like more than two decades now. And I also lived in a very urban environment. So my experience of all that is very different. So I don't really have the data to say whether there's caste discrimination or not. So I usually, if someone tells me they've experienced caste discrimination, I'll take it on their word. But I think there is enough good scholarship that points to the fact that the way that caste is experienced today is a product of the British. And that's all that I wanted to say on there. And the other thing was weird was nobody came and asked me for permission to do that. Like, they just took my words, and I get that HD is a public group and maybe fair game. But at the same time, they didn't even ask me what I meant by it. They didn't give me a chance to say anything other than I'm going to call you a Hindu supremacist. And the other really concerning thing about that study was that they went into private Facebook groups and matrimonial groups and like decided that they were Hindu supremacist based on random quotes. And some of the quotes didn't even match what they were actually saying in that paper. I was really surprised that Johns Hopkins even published it.
Yeah, no, it's a huge red flag for ethics. I don't know how that, I mean, I think it's a nascent field. I don't know that IRBs know how to cope with this type of online research yet, but yeah, it was very troubling from an ethics perspective. Okay, so a couple of last questions. What are two pieces of advice that you would give Hindu American parents?
I would say from my own experience that whenever I've made Hinduism relevant to day-to-day life for kids, even my husband, who isn't a practicing Hindu, will accept some of like my values based arguments, because he also, you know, his own tradition has the same values. And he sees that, you know, when you come from a values perspective, it's a lot easier for people to relate to that, kids to relate to that, because it makes it relevant for their day-to-day lives. And I think kids actually inherently somehow want to be, have a desire to be like upright people, have be just, be fair, like fairness. Actually, I've noticed with my kid that she really cares about fairness. So that's a drive for her. So when you bring Hinduism and you talk about, the reason why we're kind to the planet is because we're part of one big family, that really like makes sense to kids. So I would focus on values, and let the other expressions of Hinduism, maybe not fall aside, obviously, but see them in terms of those, reinforcing those values.
And just to clarify, when you say values, you're not talking about sort of Victorian values or conservatism or things like that. You're actually talking about a perspective of reverence in the world and kind of
Dharma.
a dharmic worldview, yeah. Not social conservatism.
No, not at all, actually. Yeah, that's a good point. When I say Hindu values, I mean the idea that we are part of the cosmos. We're literally sitting inside or are part of Purusha. And our work here is to, return to that state. And in order to do that, we need to sustain joy and love and this, bring each other towards oneness. Like that, that's the values that I uphold as a Hindu, not the, I think the conservative family stuff has its place. Like you having healthy families, whatever that might look like, is really helpful in your pursuit of Dharma, because you can't have, when you're in a state of disagreement or fight or conflict within your family, whatever that looks like, it's really hard to be a practice. It affects your practice. It affects your way that you react to people. And inherently, you can feel that disharmony in your life. So having strong families is important. But at the same time, it's not like the reason for that is not onto itself a good thing. It's because it helps us be dharmic that I think,
yeah,
having strong families or good education, all those things matter.
Yeah. All right. And your advice to kids growing up here, Hindu?
Just being inquisitive, like ask your parents why they do puja the way they do. Like, a lot of kids I've heard that people like just don't even ask because that's not what they're used to. It's not modeled in their family. So they feel like it's not okay to do that. But actually what I've seen is parents might not do it because they're not used to it, but they're really actually a lot of times they're happy to explain or find the answers or go to someone. I think also parents realize that we're in a culture which kids want to know the underlying reasons for things. So I think parents are much more open to this. I think ask, and have shraddha, have faith.
Yeah. Beautiful. All right. Well, we know that we can find you at Hindu Decoloniality. What are your other social media handles, places people can follow your work?
You guys can find me on Instagram at Sneha Rao 9904. And you can find me on Facebook under just Sneha Rao. I think I'll just pop up if you search me on Facebook because I'm very active there. And then I have a Twitter handle, Sneha Rao 994. So you can find me there as well. And messaging works pretty good for me.
Great. And then what do you have coming up that's exciting or interesting that you want people to know about? Anything that you're doing?
I'm really, so a project that I've been working on is how to understand the Guru Shishya Parampara, how to identify Guru, why the Guru, how to understand Gurus who traveled outside of India, like Swami Vivekananda, or, you know, going up to like Gurudev Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, right? The range of Gurus that have come, how the history and the events that were occurring in the in the globe affect them, and why they, so that this is part of the project that I've been working on for a while and putting together a lot of data. So I hope that soon it will come out as either articles or published journal. And one of my articles did get accepted for at Harvard Divinity. And it's around gurus and also on how to build communities, like spiritual communities that are healthy, how to recognize a proper guru, all these things. So I hope that that will come out soon as well. So, yeah.
Wonderful. And you're presenting that at a conference at Harvard, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm presenting that in April.
Wonderful. Well, it is, as always, been an absolute delight to hear your perspectives, hear about your experiences, and I'm sure we'll have you back. Thank you so much, Sneha.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of That's So Hindu. If you enjoyed it, please take a minute and leave us a nice 5-star review. It's how you can help the show get discovered by more listeners. You can help ensure that more of these get made by making a donation to HAF at hinduamerican.org/donate. Thanks again for listening.